From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The NFL has put its fist down over illegal hits. Ahead on Only a Game, will the new enforcement of old rules protect the players? Also, super sleuth Doug Trabu attempts to unlock the secret of an 18th century portrait that some feel could be the first ever depiction of baseball. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar speaks to a Massachusetts Jewish group about an African-American World War II tank battalion. Also, Iraqi rowers come to Boston for the head of the Charles Regatta.
It's amazing watching guys, you know, conversing amongst themselves in Arabic, working together in a boat, trying to do the same motion as guys who are speaking American. It really was a special moment, and it's what sport's for. You know, if it doesn't bring people together, why are we doing it?
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Sunday's barrage of illegal hits prompted the NFL to re-examine the way it enforces its rules. The league handed out $175,000 in fines to three defensive players, and on Thursday it sent a message to all 32 teams clarifying the new policy. An accompanying video purports to demonstrate what constitutes a flagrant violation of the rules. Joining me now on the line is Sports Illustrated senior writer Peter King. Peter, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be on.
Briefly, what are the new punishments?
Well, I think what the NFL has said, they haven't instituted any new rules. What they have said is that they are going to be a lot stricter and tougher in the disciplining, in the discipline process. And I think some of the hits that we saw in the games last weekend, at least one of them, I believe, the Brandon Merriweather hit with the New England Patriots, on Todd Heap of the Baltimore Ravens, that hit in the future is going to draw a suspension. But what they're trying to say to players is, if you launch at defenseless receivers, there's a good chance you're going to be suspended. And if you use your helmet to contact other players in the helmet, you're probably going to be suspended as well.
As you have suggested, Commissioner Goodell has said this is not a new rule, it's a matter of enforcing rules already in place. Why wasn't the league enforcing those rules before this weekend?
Well, that's a great question. I'm of the opinion that the league, basically, in responding so vehemently and so almost angrily after some of last Sunday's hits, they're kind of the league that cried wolf in not making a suspension, which has always been in the NFL's sort of discipline playbook. They've always been able to suspend guys if they view that a hit is over the line. And in the past 3 years, they've suspended three guys for hits that they considered particularly egregious. So the NFL has been enforcing this, but I just don't think they've been as aggressive in enforcing it. And Brandon Merriweather, for instance, was basically docked 1.5 game checks for his helmet-to-helmet hit on Todd Heap. So he's going to be playing the San Diego Chargers Sunday for free. And then the first half of the next game for free as well.
Brandon Merriweather initially said he would not change his approach. Later he said he was sorry. Steelers linebacker James Harrison, who was fined $75,000 for a hit on Sunday, initially threatened to retire, but he's apparently changed his mind.
You know why he changed his mind? I'll give you 22 million reasons why he changed his mind.
That's the same 22 million I thought probably were in play. Meanwhile, Miami linebacker Channing Crowder was not fined this week, but he has insisted that he will, quote, keep using his helmet. Some players seem to be confused about what they are allowed to do and not allowed to do. Should they be?
Well, I think they should be because, I mean, I've had conversations with players during the course of this past week, Bill, and one whom I consider one of the smartest guys who I deal with in the league on a regular basis, Keith Brooking, a linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys, told me, he said, listen, it's all well and good to have these rules, and I respect the rules, and I don't want to hit anybody illegally. But the fact is, when an offensive player comes barreling into you or comes barreling toward you, and then lowers his head to sort of kind of put his head into your midsection or put his shoulder pads into your midsection, you're taught to try to get low on that guy, to try to get leverage on that guy. And he said there is an absolutely unavoidable path that's going to follow. Some helmets are going to make contact with each other. I think, Bill, what the defensive players in the league by and large say is this game is already tilted toward the offensive players, and now it's tilted even more so to the offensive players because we're the ones who are going to get blamed when there's a helmet-to-helmet hit, and yet oftentimes it's the offensive player lowering his helmet into ours.
Well, now I'm confused.
I am too.
will these new rules or the new enforcement of old rules change the way football is played in the NFL?
I really thought earlier in the week that there was a good chance that they would change how the game was played. But, Bill, I think what this sort of call to arms has done is this is going to do a good job of eliminating the kind of hit, and I wish we had video on the radio so people could see what was a totally stupid, needless, egregious hit by Brandon Merriweather on Todd Heap, where he just went helmet to helmet on purpose. You could just see it. But the fact is, I don't think very many defensive players are going to change the way they play starting Sunday, Week 7 in the NFL.
Current NBC analyst and retired defensive back Rodney Harrison is the NFL's all-time leader in fines for violent hits, and even he is calling for suspensions in addition to increased fines. Does it seem to you ironic the league has apparently listened to him?
Very much so. I mean, Rodney Harrison has gotten religion. Bill, a part of my job now, as well as working for Sports Illustrated, I work for NBC also on Sundays, and so I sit with Rodney Harrison, and we watch the games together, Rodney, Tony Dungy, and Dan Patrick, and a lot of the behind-the-scenes people. And so we watch the games together, and last Sunday, I can just tell you that Rodney Harrison, he said at one point, he goes, boy, thank God I retired. And he just, because he was cringing, he said, I can't believe that I was a part of that. And I think a lot of guys who have retired, and I've talked to several of them this week, multiple concussion victims who are struggling a little bit in their private lives now. I think a lot of them are saying, look, this is not anything I wanted to hear when I played, but these players, they've got to listen to this. We know it's a tough game. Some of what's going to happen is unavoidable, but these helmet-to-helmet shots, the NFL has got to do everything they can to get those out of the game.
Peter King is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Peter, thank you very much for talking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Have a great day.
8,000 rowers have converged on Boston this weekend for the Head of the Charles Regatta. The event is billed as the world's largest two-day rowing event, with athletes representing 600 different universities and rowing clubs from all over the world. But no team is getting more attention than the five rowers and one alternate from Iraq. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
During their 6 weeks in the United States, members of the Iraqi national rowing team have gotten used to photo ops after being interviewed by everyone from CNN to USA Today. On this Sunday morning, less than a week before the Head of the Charles, and seconds before they're to push off for a camera-friendly race in Boston, they've discovered a problem.
Mr. Bruce?
Bruce Smith, executive director of community rowing and coach at Riverside Boat Club, rushes over to sort out an improperly placed pontoon. Normally, the Iraqi national team doesn't use pontoons, rowing's equivalent of training wheels. But today, instead of perfecting their technique with advice from U.S. experts, they're teaching rowing to members of the U.S. military, all of whom have served in Iraq.
Attention, go!
Three. Four, three. Three, four, three.
As the mixed teams of Iraqis and Iraq War vets take off on a friendly race on the Charles River, the sounds of camera shutters almost drown out the sounds of oars. Bruce Smith says the Iraqis are enthusiastic rowers wherever they go, but today's event is special.
It's amazing. And watching guys, you know, conversing amongst themselves in Arabic, working together in a boat, trying to do the same motion as guys who are speaking American, it really was a special moment, and it's what sport's for. You know, if it doesn't bring people together, why are we doing it?
Lieutenant Colonel John Richardson served three tours in Iraq, where members of the U.S. military are often asked to train Iraqis. He enjoyed today's role reversal.
You could just see the pride that they had, that they know that they are experts. And they brought us in today, set us down, and they were fabulous instructors. The team is made up of Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds, which to me it just captures the Iraq success story. And so it was an honor for me to actually get in a boat with a bunch of guys, because I know where they came from and what they've been through for the last, not just 10 years, but really about the last 40 years.
Richardson says he's not surprised that Iraq is stable enough to field teams for international sporting events, but he was surprised that a rowing team is among them.
Iraqi crew, I never would have thought. I mean, they do have some pretty big rivers that run through that country, but they are, I mean, they're excellent athletes. They clearly know their stuff, and I look forward to seeing them racing the head of the Charles next weekend.
As the teams carry their boats back to the bay, Lieutenant Colonel Tom Watson, one of the lucky few who didn't get drenched during the race, is looking forward to spending some more time with the Iraqi rowers.
Oh, this is great. Good to see some Iraqi people here. But, you know, as we get a chance to mingle a little bit, we'll talk about where they're from, how things are in Iraq. But just the fact that they're over here rowing, that's a good sign.
Watson didn't get the chance to ask that question. The Iraqis left before lunch to find dry clothes and to avoid a meal that would make it even harder to drop weight before this weekend's races. But a few days later, while his teammates warm up at the Riverside Boat Club, Haider Rashid answers the question of how things are going back home.
Well, now it's getting better by time, not like before. We have a lot of checkpoint. But anyway, it's getting better than before. We feel safe. There's a lot of checkpoints, like I said, from my home to my training. I saw like 4 or 5 checkpoints, and it's only 10 minutes by bicycle. So you see a soldier from government, checkpoint, all the cars, everybody who have luggage, who have anything. So you feel better.
Rashid's been rowing since 2003. He's won gold at the Arab Games, silver at the Asian Games, and represented his country at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And while he hasn't always felt safe traveling to and from training sessions, he never worries when he's on the water.
Now we are fine in the water. You know, it feels like our water. Yeah, it's very nice.
Rashid will find out if the Charles River is also his water this afternoon in the men's championship singles. His teammates will compete tomorrow afternoon in the head of the Charles lightweight fours. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It is 230 feet long, it weighs almost a ton, and it will feed a family of, oh, I don't know, several hundred? The toothsome construction with which the residents of Iztapalapa, a borough of Mexico City, broke the Guinness record for largest enchilada was meant to convince people that, quote, Iztapalapa is a high-level tourist destination. So spoke the tourism secretary of Mexico City, Alejandro Rojas. The enchilada included corn tortillas, white onions, serrano chilies, green tomatoes, avocado cheese, and a veritable sea of salsa. And now, if you'll excuse me, I have to find something to eat. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the NBA's all-time scoring leader rolls into town to celebrate a tank battalion. But first, over the course of their history, the New York Yankees have won 40 pennants. The Texas Rangers have won one. That one came last night when Alex Rodriguez, formerly a Ranger, currently a Yankee, took a called third strike to end the Texas drought. Final score, Rangers 6, Yankees 1. The Rangers won the American League Championship Series 4-2. Game 6 of the National League Championship Series will transpire tonight in Philadelphia. If the San Francisco Giants can win that one, they'll join the Rangers in the World Series. If not, the Giants and Phillies will play Game 7 tomorrow. It's week 8 of the college football season. Here to discuss this weekend's big matchups and to espouse his undying love for the BCS format is our college football guy, Yahoo Sports national columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Bill, I know you've been following closely the college football season.
Yes, absolutely. You have a new book out this week titled Death to the BCS, the definitive case against the Bowl Championship Series. Not much confusion there in the title. Does that mean you don't like the system as it currently exists?
Bill, it's a mystery book. We do not want to give away the last page. Yes, death to the BCS. Like most fans, I find the BCS infuriating for many reasons. And so as an investigative reporter, we decided, and a couple other guys, we decided to follow the money, see why this thing's going, see who's actually making money off it and blocking progress, how the computers don't work, how the polls don't work, how the games change, you name it. We unearth it, and fans all over seem excited about it.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the teams that will be playing today. The rap against Boise State, which is currently ranked 2 on 3 polls, but only at number 3 in the BCS rankings, is that it plays a weak schedule in a weak conference. Is the Western Athletic Conference really that bad, or is that just whack?
It has some terrible teams in it, no question. Boise State has an easier path than the other schools. Now, it has a long winning streak over its major conference foes, so anyone willing to play them has lost, including Oregon, which they beat last year. We know they've defeated Oklahoma, which is number one in the BCS standings, so it's kind of tough for Boise State. They win the rare opportunities they have, but then get punished because no one wants to play them.
Does the animosity directed at Boise State really have to do with the fact that their vibrant blue home turf is called Smurf Turf, and football fans just don't like Smurfs?
I think the Smurf Turf is actually quite popular. In a genius bit of sports marketing, they dared to throw blue turf up there because they're a fledgling program in Idaho, and if you don't do something, no one will ever pay attention to you. It's proved to be quite successful. The TV executives love it. So I think most people kind of like it. There's no question there's animosity on Boise State, though. They've become the new Notre Dame. Boise State is seen by the fans of the big conference teams as a fraudulent contender. And then at the same time, they're one of the most popular teams in the country because so many people love the underdog story and the fact that the establishment tries to keep them down. It's a very polarizing team. It's really a fascinating storyline.
The tilt between number 6 LSU and number 4 Auburn is today's only matchup between top 10 teams. How significant is that game in the big picture?
It's very significant because one of these two teams will be undefeated in the SEC. And if you're going to come through the SEC undefeated at the end, you're probably going to play for the BCS championship, although Auburn has done it before and been excluded. The game is at Auburn. Both teams still have to play Alabama, which has one loss, but this is a real stepping stone for either one of them. LSU is unbeaten but has won games in truly lunatic fashion, consistent with their coach, Les Miles, who's known as the Mad Hatter for the both unique way he wears his baseball cap and the bizarre way he calls plays and handles the clock and talks. This is the Yogi Berra of college football. Auburn, though, has a great Heisman candidate in Cam Newton and is playing at home, and I think I would give the nod to Auburn in that.
Also noteworthy is the game between number 1 Oklahoma and number 11 Missouri. Does the Tigers' defense play well enough to upend the nation's top team?
It's going to be a real test. Missouri has not played great competition, but they have looked very good in what they're doing. It's at home, arguably the biggest game in Columbia, Missouri in many years. And we don't know about this Oklahoma team. They have snuck by a lot of clubs. They're number 1 in the BCS because the computers which are not based on any known mathematical formulas, actually, and are being protested by actual quantitative analysts, but why let that get in the way of the system? The human polls have them as low as 4, but the Sooners are beloved by the computers. That's why they're number one. If Missouri's as good as they've looked against inferior competition, they can certainly spring this upset.
Which, if any, of the other games being played today will you be watching?
TCU has is another kind of Boise State-esque game, and they have a tricky contest against Air Force, which is puts together a very strong club and was ranked as recently as last week. Michigan State is undefeated for the first time at this stage of the year, and I think 40 years since Bubba Smith was around. They have a chance of running undefeated in the Big Ten, although they're very under the radar because they don't have that great brand name. They're Michigan State, not Ohio State, not Michigan. Wisconsin and Iowa play this week also, a game that also will have big ramifications in the Big Ten. So this is a time of year where the contenders and the pretenders start getting sorted out. You can't hide from your tougher games in conference.
Dan, we're about midway through the season. Which teams' successes or failures have surprised you so far?
You know, it's an interesting. They had a story in the Wall Street Journal this week about the rise of the middle class. The one place the middle class is rising, I guess, in America is college football. What we've seen over the last few years, particularly as both the internet, the impact of the internet, and the impact of the just proliferation of televised college football games, are recruits who are willing to go outside their geographic area or change the way they choose schools based on playing time. You used to be you'd go to Ohio State and wait 3 years for your chance to start as a senior. Nowadays, kids want to play right away, and very good players are willing to go to all different types of places, whether that's middle-level programs in the Big Ten like a Michigan State, an Iowa, a Wisconsin, not those traditional superpowers, or Missouri in the Big 12 or Auburn in the SEC. But you see, I just think a lot more parity in the middle of the big-name conferences, not just the rise of TCU and Boise.
Dan Wetzel is Yahoo Sports national columnist and the co-author of the just-released Death to the BCS, published by Gotham Press. Dan, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Last Sunday afternoon in Worcester, Massachusetts, as the technicians in the Hanover Theater made adjustments to their sound system, Howard Borer, the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Central Massachusetts, discussed the man who would soon be speaking to several hundred people under the auspices of the Federation. Mr. Borer acknowledged that he'd never heard the speaker, but said he was excited by the Federation's choice.
I think it's fascinating that you have an African-American Muslim speaking on behalf of the Jews and talking about the experiences that both African Americans and the Jewish people experienced in trying to fight bigotry and prejudice.
The man Howard Borer described was instantly recognizable when he strode onto the stage.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Because he is a little over 7 feet tall. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, best known for scoring more points than anybody else in the history of the National Basketball Association, is also an author, an actor of sorts, a coach, and a lecturer. His subject on Sunday was Brothers in Arms, a book he co-wrote several years ago. It's the story of the 761st Tank Battalion, a unit of African-American soldiers who endured racism and bigotry, distinguished themselves in battle during World War II, and participated in the liberation of several concentration camps in Germany. As Kareem Abdul-Jabbar pointed out in his presentation, previous to the Second World War, black soldiers and sailors had been saddled with menial work, and even during that war, black units that had been trained to fight were often prevented from doing so. As a child, Kareem knew one of the men who had served with the 761st Tank Battalion, Leonard Smitty Smith. The desire to tell the story of what Smith and his comrades had accomplished drove Kareem to investigate the circumstances of the 761st and to write the book. When he'd completed his remarks, the author invoked a wider context for his work.
Knowledge is power. And when you have the power of knowledge, you're able to make changes.
The subject of Kareem's lecture notwithstanding, when he offered to take questions from the audience, the first person to reach the microphone did not have the 761st on his mind.
Who's your favorite NBA player to play against?
The speaker handled the jump and subject with grace, citing Hall of Famer Nate Thurmond, late of the Warriors, Bulls, and Cavaliers, as the man who played him hardest. About half of the questions that followed had to do with basketball, and one particularly personal inquiry came from a fan who wanted to know why the speaker had chosen to attend UCLA rather than Holy Cross, right there in Worcester, where Kareem's high school coach had just assumed control of the program.
I came up here and visited Holy Cross, and when I visited Los Angeles, just the difference in the weather. The fact that the University of California, Los Angeles had co-eds. That was a big factor in me choosing to go to UCLA. Plus, Coach Wooden was a pretty good coach.
After Kareem had left the stage, I asked him whether it bothered him that so many of the audience members wanted to hear about basketball rather than the subject of his book.
It's okay. You know, people wouldn't come here if I hadn't had the basketball career that I had. They wouldn't know who I was, and they probably wouldn't have bought my book. So, you know, just the prominence that I achieved as an athlete gives me access to the public that a lot of authors don't have. So I've tried to use it in the most positive way I can.
Though his subject had been the achievements of a particular battalion of black soldiers during World War II, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was born Lew Alcindor, was obviously aware of the symbolic importance of the appearance of a man who has embraced Islam at an event sponsored by a Jewish federation. His attempt to encourage tolerance and understanding is ongoing, wide-ranging, and, he acknowledged, often challenging, albeit welcome.
It's not a difficult fight. It's discouraging that we have to have this fight now. I remember when I was learning about Islam, back in the 60s, I went to a bookstore in Brooklyn, in an Arab area of Brooklyn, and that bookstore had been there since the 1920s. Muslims have been living here in America under the radar for a very long time, but all of a sudden now, they're a problem.
In addition to his As Told To autobiographies and Brothers in Arms, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has written or co-written Black Profiles in Courage, A Season on the Reservation, which is about his time coaching Apache children, and On the Shoulders of Giants, A Journey Through the Harlem Renaissance, the story of the Harlem Wrens basketball team. Lately, he's been involved in making a film based on that story. If people who know Kareem only as the NBA's leading scorer are surprised by these achievements, it is perhaps because they have taken for granted the sort of stereotype which Kareem proves hollow simply by being who he is.
The way I tell people, I probably would have been a writer or a teacher if I had to have a real job. But basketball loomed its head and gave me an outlet for having a career. But I've always enjoyed reading and tried my hand at writing as early as grade school, and I was always kind of pretty good at it, so it's just something that came naturally to me.
With that, the author and former basketball player stood up, and then stood up some more, and reached down to shake my hand and left the room. For the next hour or so, as a long line of potential readers shuffled past him in the lobby of the Hanover Theater, Kareem signed copies of his book about the 761st and answered the occasional question about his skyhook, too. You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, Charlie Pierce and I briefly discussed a race walker named Ronnie Yadav who had been disqualified from the competition at the Commonwealth Games after a positive drug test. Ashish Shah, who hears the program on WBUR, wrote to ask for a correction in that conversation because I referred to Ronnie Yadav as he, Ashish Shah wrote, NPR should at a minimum get the gender right in its broadcasts, and that's true. Rani Yadav is a woman who was disqualified from competition as a racewalker because of a positive drug test at the Commonwealth Games. My apologies. Stuart Weinograd, who hears only a game on KIOS in Omaha, was unhappy when Charlie mentioned that Nebraska had played a more challenging schedule than Boise State so far this football season. Nebraska has played Western Kentucky, 0-16, the past 2 years, and there is not a team on their schedule currently ranked higher than number 20. If you're going to criticize Boise State's schedule, don't pick Nebraska as a better alternative, he wrote. Speaking of my weekly conversations with Charlie, Bill Ball, another WBUR listener, wrote this week to say, I'm upset with the way Bill Littlefield thinks every exchange is funny, which in turn causes him to cackle. I don't know whether he's trying to imitate Heckle or Jekyll. I suggest that he give up on the phony comedy and concentrate on his day job. Oops, sorry. My favorite tweet of the week came from someone identifying himself as At Roost, and he or she is responding to a music choice we made last week. Ah, my ears, the headphones, they do nothing. Only a Game is now the second NPR program to trick me into listening to a Justin Bieber song. And finally, we heard this week from Eric Peterson, the head of school at St. George's Academy in Rhode Island. Mr. Peterson is the guy who pulled his school's football team out of a game in which the St. George's linemen would have been outweighed by 100 to 150 pounds. We've had a great many schools and school personnel express their support, he wrote, and there have been many, many other expressions of support from parents, alumni, friends, and strangers. Now we're moving on with the season. It's time to get back to our work of teaching and coaching some talented, promising young people. You can respond to what you hear on Only a Game by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
On Friday, John Geary, a member of the high school football team in Rockland, Maine, jumped onto the hood of a car as it was traveling through the school parking lot. Bad move. Young Geary slipped off the hood and fell under one of the tires, where he was trapped when the car stopped. Happily, six of his teammates and a couple of adults on the scene were able to tilt the car up and hold it off Geary's back for 20 minutes when an ambulance finally arrived. Rockland High won their game the next day, and John Geary, who was expected to make a full recovery, was awarded the game ball, presumably because by then he had acknowledged that jumping on his teammate's car was a really dumb idea. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Gumshoe Doug Trabu investigates what may be the earliest depiction of baseball. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look at the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Cave paintings?
Well, we just have to listen and find out, won't we? Are you prepared to speak of fines and potential suspensions, not to mention liability, which is another way of saying, are you ready for some football?
Yeah, this has been a week in which the NFL has had to confront the essential nature of its sport, which is basically that it destroys the human body. I think any discussion of this has to start with that. There is no way to make professional football at the level it's played now with the size of the people playing it safe. You can't do it. You can make it a little bit less deliberately violent, but that's it.
Well, last weekend's games did result in several concussions. This is not news, but they also resulted in hefty fines and eventually a video message from the NFL illustrating illegal versus legal hits. Is this going to change anything over time?
Over time, maybe. I think over time, they're going to realize that people really don't want to spend $250 a pop to watch a cockfight, which is basically what they're watching now.
Ben Roethlisberger, who has just returned to the Steelers after serving a 4-game suspension essentially for embarrassing the league with his behavior, has suffered numerous concussions. Were you surprised by his take on fining, potential suspensions, things of that nature?
Well, obviously the concussions have had an effect because he said he'd rather have a concussion than have his knee taken out.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many levels of football stupid in that one statement, it's hard to parse them all out.
Former pro player and coach Mike Ditka said this week that if the league eliminated face masks on helmets, or maybe even eliminated helmets altogether, there might be fewer head injuries. What's the chance anybody in a high place will listen to him?
He's not the first person I've heard mention this. There have been talk radio hosts, there have been football analysts who said that if you went back to the single bar face mask, people would be less inclined to use their heads and turn their bodies into projectiles. That may be true. It also may be that we just go back to the days of wide receivers taking forearms to the thoracic vertebra on the way over the middle.
College football's AP number one, Oregon, made a strong case for title contention with their 60-13 drubbing of UCLA on Thursday night. I just love saying this. Do you like the Ducks?
Oh, the Ducks in their Nike uniforms. Either they're really good or UCLA is really terrible. This is what you do because the one thing we all have to remember about Oregon is they're not number one in the only poll that matters, which is the BCS poll. That's Oklahoma. So this was a statement game for them, and I suspect as long as they're number one in the AP poll, which really sort of doesn't matter very much, but not number one in the BCS poll, you're going to see a lot of 60-point games from these guys. I mean, I noticed that they did pull their starters, they did clear the bench, but they were also still running a hurry-up offense up, 40 or 50 points. So they're very serious about establishing a resume.
Magic Johnson has sold his small ownership stake in the Lakers, and he has also unloaded the Starbucks outlets that he had previously accumulated. Any idea what he's planning to do with the cash?
He's ready for some football, Bill.
Good time to get into the business.
Right before the lockout. Mm-hmm. He wants to buy. He made $75 million selling the Starbucks back to the company, which I guess is the way things happen. He wants to bring an NFL team back to Los Angeles.
Believe it or not, it's almost time for the NBA season to start. Have you a pick?
Well, who do I like is the question?
Yeah,
I like
ahead.
Two things. I like Shaquille O'Neal for sitting on a bench in Harvard Square and pretending to be a statue for 2 hours, which is the coolest thing that's happened in the NBA in a long while. I have to go with the chalk in the East. I think Miami's going to win. I think the Celtics and Miami's going to be a fascinating back and forth all season. In the West, I see the Lakers. I don't see a second place team. I'm going to say San Antonio, but Oklahoma City's going to make me regret it.
On Thursday, NBA Commissioner David Stern announced that the league is seeking a 33% reduction in player salaries in the next collective bargaining agreement in order to return to profitability. Stern ended his comments by saying, "That's our story and we're sticking to it." Well, all righty then.
Excellent. You know what? It is the biggest load of hogwash that's come down Fifth Avenue in a long time. Return to profitability? When an NBA owner sells me an apple from a steam grate in front of the Boston Public Library, then I'll worry about profit. Do you think when David Stern goes overseas to gather more corporate partners from the business elites of Europe and Asia, he says, "Invest in our product, even though we're not making money."
Defending champion Duke earned top votes in the preseason men's basketball coaches poll. Duke lost 3 of their top starters from last year. They're replacing them with freshmen and a transfer. What is this? Do coaches just see the name Duke and check the number one box?
Kids, the eyes don't blink for a while and they start walking. Well, this is fine for Duke. I hope they're happy, but I would point out that they are playing Marquette in the first week of the season, so
the dream dies.
They enjoy it while you can, boys.
Facing elimination from the National League Championship Series, Roy Halladay pitched through a strained groin muscle to help the Philadelphia Phillies win 4-2 over San Francisco on Thursday. The series returns to Philadelphia today. So, can the Phillies win twice and get into the World Series?
I think Philadelphia can win today. I'm not sure they can win in 7 games. This is turning into a very interesting series, largely because the Giants, whom I have not followed at all because they're on the West Coast and in Boston they might as well be playing on Pluto, are a very fun ball club to watch.
Money troubles in NASCAR, Charlie. Richard Petty Motorsports says there's no guarantee they can keep the team's 4 Sprint Cup cars on the track through the season, and the NASCAR Hall of Fame needs to trim $2.5 to $3 million out of the budget due to lower than expected attendance. What the heck's going on, Mr. NASCAR?
I have no idea. I mean, we're probably getting to the point with the economy the way it is where racing teams aren't going to be able to run 4 cars at the highest level. As for the Hall of Fame, these people expected 250 and 350,000 people a year to go to the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Most of the people who follow NASCAR spend all their money going to the races. Their idea of a vacation is packing up the RV and going to Bristol and seeing a race, not packing up the RV and going to Charlotte and seeing a museum.
And finally, Charlie, Liverpool, the soccer team recently acquired by Red Sox owner John Henry, is having a miserable season, and the British press has been poking a good deal of fun at the club. This week, reporters claimed that the most famous person on the plane carrying Liverpool to an away game was the pilot. Can that have been true?
It is. It was the lead singer of Iron Maiden, Bruce Dickinson, who's a pilot and a world-class fencer, by the way, and has been for a long while and almost made the British Olympic team once. So he's always been my favorite heavy metal vocalist. He's also a licensed pilot, and he flew the plane.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Sometimes a story just comes together, and other times it's not so simple. For much of this year, Only a Game's Doug Tribou has been tracking a sports mystery. Unfortunately, he hasn't been able to crack the case yet. Still, the investigation has yielded some interesting results.
It was a cold winter day. I was in my office, feet on my desk, scotch in my hand, hoping another case would come along. That's when she walked through my door. Okay, it was a little less dramatic than that. One morning in February, I got to work, sat down in front of my computer, opened an email, skimmed the text, and clicked on the attachment. An image appeared. Two boys, probably between the ages of 10 and 13 years old. One boy has dark skin, one light. They're both holding bats, and one boy's holding a ball. Just an ordinary sports scene. Except the boys are wearing long frocks and white dress shirts with broad, frilly collars, and the image is a black and white copy of an oil painting done more than 200 years ago. Mario Valdes is the man who sent the email, and he's been thinking about that image off and on for the past 35 years. Valdes is a freelance researcher based in Boston who focuses primarily on genealogy and African American history projects. He first saw the double portrait in an issue of the art magazine Apollo.
Back in 1975, I stumbled on an advertisement by Bonhams for the sale of this painting, described as a piece by Ralph Earle. I was quite intrigued by it because one of the kids was black or Indian, I couldn't tell. But of course, that's what caught my attention.
Before I go any further, if you'd like to examine the portrait yourself, you can see it at onlyagame.org. The magazine ad lists the title as Double Portrait of Two Boys with Baseball Bats, but Valdes saw the painting as an unusual black history item. Over the years, he did some digging in his spare time, but it was three decades before Valdes realized the painting's potential significance in the world of sports. In 2004, research by historian John Thorne led to the discovery of a 1791 Pittsfield, Massachusetts bylaw containing the earliest written reference to baseball in North America. Valdes says when he heard the news, the portrait immediately came to mind.
And that's when I thought, my God, everyone's going ballistic over just this one little description, this one little mention of a baseball. And I'm sitting on what claims to be the earliest painting of baseball, if it indeed is baseball.
Valdes picked up his research again, starting with a call to Bonhams, the London auction house where it was sold, but the company had destroyed its records from that time. Valdes didn't give up. He spoke to baseball and cricket historians, contacted art experts, and even learned the boys' frilly collars most likely date the painting to the late 1700s. But while tidbits of information piled up, the painting's location was still a mystery. So when Valdes contacted me to see if I wanted to try to solve the case for a radio story, I began by talking with him at length. Then I started down some of the same roads he'd already followed and also went down several new ones.
Then, in 1927, he began hitting home runs at a pace close to his record-setting season of 1921.
In April, I made a trip to the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York, to talk with senior curator Tom Schieber. Schubert says there aren't many objects children in an 18th century portrait could be holding that would really grab our attention in 2010.
What I think is so neat about this is that we're interested in it. That's what's neat about it, because it tells you that baseball means something to people, even to those who are not particularly interested in the sport. It's in our language. It's in the clothes we wear. It's in the advertising that is bombarded into your head every day. It's everywhere you look. You know, you talk about rose-colored glasses. We're wearing baseball-colored glasses here, and then so we're seeing baseball in this image.
It was reassuring that Schubert shared my enthusiasm, but his assessment of what the painting might tell us was less optimistic.
This particular painting, there's not a lot of to grab onto. We don't have a good look at the objects that interest us, the ball and the bats. You know, it's possible that ball has some stitching on it. That might lend a clue. I just can't tell from this image. There's a background that's not helping me out right now, and maybe we could try and figure out where it is. I'm not even sure if we did how much that would help. So there's not a lot to go on here.
The best available clues are in the 1975 magazine ad, which lists Ralph Earle as the artist. Earle was a prolific portrait painter who was born in Massachusetts in 1751 and worked throughout the Northeast. He died in 1801, so at least that confirms it's an American painting, right? Not so fast. Earle was born in the American colonies, but was loyal to the crown. He fled to England in 1777 during the Revolution and didn't return until 1785. Beth Hise is a museum curator who lives in Sydney, Australia. She organized an exhibit titled Swinging Away, How Cricket and Baseball Connect, which is showing in London and coming to the Baseball Hall of Fame next year. Hise says 18th and 19th century English portraits of people holding cricket gear are relatively common, but if there was proof that Earle was painting American boys,
then the kind of equipment that they're holding would be the first clues that we would have of what bat and ball equipment looked like in the colonial American context, or the post-colonial American context. And so then this would be an extraordinarily significant painting. But if we don't know that, then it becomes an interesting painting that's potentially part of an English tradition.
The boys are dressed identically, in upper-class fashion. There's also a sense of closeness, with the dark-skinned boy resting his hand on the other's shoulder, a pose that often suggests the subjects are family members. Genealogical research eventually led Mario Valdes to theorize the boys were members of the Rogers family, a prominent Connecticut clan that had some interracial marriages.
The fact that there was this portrait, the fact that the way they're dressed, since Earle is painting in Connecticut, in the Connecticut area, and that's primarily his home base, it stands a good chance to be them.
But in a development I'm beginning to get used to, there's another complication. Despite the description in the 1975 ad, it's not certain that Ralph Earle was in fact the artist. After calls to the Smithsonian and other museums, I eventually found a curator who's an expert on Earle. Betsy Kornhauser of the Metropolitan Museum of Art was with the Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford, Connecticut when we spoke this spring. She told me without seeing the actual painting, she couldn't be certain it was Earle's work, and added that a number of portraits have been mistakenly credited to him. So I was back to staring at the ball and bats. And here's one fact I can confirm. Studying an image for clues is tricky business. When you see something incomplete, like a word missing letters, your mind automatically tries to fill in blanks. One boy's leaning on a bat, but we only see the handle. The other is holding his bat under his arm. We see both ends, but not the middle. I needed help, and I turned to David Block.
You know, I love stuff like this. I love historical mysteries, and I love, you know, stuff having to do with baseball.
Block is the author of Baseball Before We Knew It, and an expert on early bat and ball games that contributed to the evolution of baseball. He says the ball could have been used in a number of games, but the two bats are even tougher to pin down and might even be different types.
The longer one appears to have a knob on the end that the fellow's resting his hand on. Well, the one on the right is a one-handed bat, fairly thin. And if I were to speculate as to what that bat most likely would be used for from that era, I would say the game of trap ball.
But what about the title? Double portrait of two boys with baseball bats. Nearly all of the historians I spoke with agree it's most likely a description written by the auctioneers. Unlike the ad, the earliest American references to baseball are almost always written as two words, and a different game by the same name in England was written as two words or separated with a hyphen. In other words, it's another dead end. Over the past 9 months, I've hit a lot of them and come up empty. It's been fun and frustrating. But I take comfort in the words of Baseball Hall of Fame senior curator Tom Schieber, who's done a lot more of this kind of work than I ever will.
To me, it's about the means. It's not necessarily about the end. So the research process, to me, is the most fun. If I can get something neat at the end, great. But it can't just be about the end, because a lot of times I don't get there.
So I'm throwing in my amateur historian towel and hanging up my research cleats. Until someone finds the actual painting, we might never know the full story of the boys and the game they played. And it's time to move on, unless I can get just one more clue. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from Mike Garth, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archive chosen stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. While there, you can view the painting about which Doug Tribou was speaking, and if you know where it is, please get in touch with Doug. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from coxswain Tom Tiffany, who compares the Iraqi rowing team competing at this weekend's Head of the Charles Regatta to a vaunted Only a Game rowing team.
Let's just say they're more powerfully trained, but they don't have quite the pizzazz.
Well, of course not. Who does? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.